Warning: this episode contains details that some listeners may find disturbing. September 20th, 1988, Berlin, New Mexico. 19-year-old Tara Calico left her home on Brug Street for a bicycle ride. She brought a Sony Walkman and planned to ride along New Mexico State Road 47 to Highway 60 and back, a 36-mile round trip that she had taken often. Tara never returned. On its surface, the Tara Calico story is an all-too-familiar missing persons case. However, strange anomalies, like a Polaroid found in Florida, and newer details that seem to point to a cover-up, make the Tara Calico case a baffling mystery. This is a study of strange. Welcome back to the show. I am your host, Michael, and I have a special guest today, Robert Cannon. Hi, Robert.
Hi.
Before I have you introduce yourself to the audience, I wanted to jump into a reenactment of a scene that happened with Tara and her mother, and then we'll back up and talk about you and a couple other things. Do you want to, we're both going to play women. It's not funny. It's not a comedy scene, but just we're the only two here, so we have to do it. Do you want to play Tara, our protagonist today, or do you want to play the mom?
On one hand, I like to be motherly, but on the other hand, I like to be mothered. I'll say dealer's choice on this. You know, I'll let you take your.
Why don't you play Tara? I like the guest to sort of take the main role. So we'll do that, and then I'll read the descriptions. Do you see the scene?
I do.
Okay, here we go.
Okay, but wait, hold on. I need direction. What am I coming from? Like, what's my motivation? How do I feel about?
That's if right. I knew you were going to be difficult, I would not have invited you on this show.
No, you knew I was going to be difficult.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
All right.
No, it's this part of the fun. Is part of the fun is not knowing. Here we go. On the morning of September 20th, 1988, Tara enters her kitchen. Her mother, Patty, is pouring a cup of coffee and keeps an eye on the TV in the nearby living room as Regis Philbin and Kathy Lee Gifford yuck it up on their new show, Regis and Kathy Lee.
Morning.
Morning, hun.
Can I borrow your bike?
Sure.
Thanks.
Tara turns to leave. Wait, why?
Mine has a flat tire.
Oh, okay then.
Oh, Mom, if I'm not home by noon, can you come get me? I'm playing tennis at 12:30 with Jack, and I don't want to be late.
Of course, hon. Carrie Mace.
I'm fine, Mom. Nothing's going to happen.
Love you. And Tara exits. Yes. So that is a recreation. We don't know what they really said, but Tara borrowed her mother's bike the morning she left, and that is the last time anybody spoke to her that we know of before Tara disappeared. Glorious acting there playing Tara Calico. By the way,
I think I nailed it.
You did a good job. By the way, it is Tara. I kept thinking in my head it's Tara.
I was gonna ask you, is it Tara or Tara?
No, so, and even what's funny, so a lot of videos, a lot of podcasts I watched as I researched this, people say Tara. I'm good friends with the Tara myself, so I kept wanting to say Tara, but it is Tara. Her family says Tara in all the interviews I've seen. Even Unsolved Mysteries says both.
I think
people go back and forth.
Side note, I think we as a society do need to come to a conclusion on this name, because it is far too confusing, right? It's not like we do Michael and then Mikal. I mean, I guess like if you're in another country, you do. But like within America, we have settled this debate. It's Michael. It's not Robert or Robert. It's like Robert. That's it.
It is Robert to me. So that's with that, Robert Cannon is my guest today, a filmmaker, a massively all around creative person. And you're going to talk about this a little bit, but he is finishing up a feature film. Can I tell people like this sort of special thing that about your film that
sure,
I like?
Yeah.
There's no lines of dialogue.
That's
in
correct.
The whole movie.
Yeah.
It is not a silent movie. There's just no dialogue. Yeah.
Yeah. It's clever because we kind of, I say clever, but it's difficult really is the word I'm looking for. But we were trying to stay true to that. And there's little moments where we want some background noise of people talking. And we had to try to find ways to do mumbles that sounded like people talking, but we didn't want to kind of get busted if someone were to analyze the audio and be like, well, there is talking in the background. It's like, all right, even that was taken care of. So we went to great lengths.
Tell people about yourself. What do you do? And obviously talk a little bit about your film too. I know you're still working on it, but I'd love for people to know about it.
So my background is in speech and debate, competitive speech and debate. I did a lot of, I came by way of acting in high school, and there were a lot of, we called them acting competitions, which were actually speech and debate competitions. And they're very similar to acting. And so I did that. And then I went to film school and for college, and then double majored in that and cinematography and photography. Worked in the film industry for a few years, and then went back to get my master's to teach. And I decided to go back and continue with collegiate speech and debate. I always wanted to get involved in film, and I got sidetracked and got involved within the speech and debate world for a number of years. And I'm still kind of very involved within that community. So I kind of have one foot in each camp, one in speech and debate and the other within the filmmaking community.
The movie that you're working on right now, what's the name of it? I know things change and we're early in the process, but like, just in case listeners get really interested in this and want to follow up and look for it in the future.
Tell sure. Us we're the film we're working on right now is called Prowler. Excuse me. And it's a, as you said, it's non-dialogue. It's a, as you can probably guess from the title, a heist and also chase movie. So the premise is that a burglar breaks into a gang's stash house and takes their drugs, and the gang then chases after him. So it all takes place over the course of one night. And the idea to do a non-dialogue movie really stems from there wasn't going to be much dialogue anyway. So we kind of felt like, why not go full gimmick and just make that a talking point. I probably shouldn't sell it like that, but but that's the truth, right? Which is like, what are we going to have them say? Like, hey, stop. And that's going to be it. So we might as well have, something to discuss.
Absolutely. I've seen footage. The reason I wanted you to talk about it is I've seen a lot of footage, and I think it's really cool. I think it's a great idea. And I like, I like suspense. And when you have something that's like a chase scene and a heist movie, there's natural suspense built in with that. And I'm really excited about it. Can't wait for it to be done.
Yeah, we're getting pretty close to the finish line.
So yeah.
We're excited.
All right. So today, thank you for being on the show. This is a bizarre story. It's very sad and heartbreaking, as these are. Normally, I don't do reenactments with this type of story because reenactments on my show tend to be kind of funny. But I wanted to have that just to show that this is a very, very normal family, normal girl. She's 19. I'll get into some more details about her in just a second. And then she just disappeared. And obviously, there's a lot of heartbreak. There's a lot of worry. There's a lot of assumptions that she's just dead. But some bizarre things happened soon after she disappeared. And then recently, just within the last couple of years, there are some updates in this case that, until more information comes out, continues to make this even more bizarre. So I will get to those as we move along.
Well, I'm interested in what the updates are, because I do want to tell you, I'm vaguely familiar with this case.
Yes,
I remember this being, I go down the rabbit hole sometimes of, I got down a rabbit hole one time looking at people's last photographs. I have a very dark side. Mm-hmm. And what's the girl? I pulled it up. It's Regina K. Walters. I found her photograph. She was kidnapped by this truck stop serial killer, and he had her in the back of his truck for like a year almost, and then he took her out to a barn and killed her. But before he killed her, he took her picture.
Oh god.
And
I just pulled it up. That's terrifying.
And she's like kind of cowering, and she's been kidnapped for a long period of time, and that's like her last photograph before she died. And when I was doing that, I came across this story where people were talking about last photographs and whether or not this is her last photograph. And some of the details are fuzzy in my brain, but I'm interested in these updates because I know this story, and I think the disappearing people, that's fascinating to me.
All right. So let me set the scene for this case, and we'll get into this photograph very soon. So this takes place in the late 80s in New Mexico, Belen. I got to say that right.
Tara or Tara? Baleen or Balin?
Exactly. It's Balin. It's Balin.
Thanks, Mikal.
Thank you. You're welcome, Robert. All right. So in Balin, New Mexico, it's a small town, roughly around 7,000 people in 1988. It's 31 miles south of Albuquerque, New Mexico. And it is very flat. I've been on Google Earth. I've watched videos of the place. It is, you know, deserty, as you would imagine in New Mexico, and very, very flat. So these roads that she ends up riding her bike on a lot, you see for a long way. It's very rural. And again, just sort of very deserty. Tara Lee Calico, she was born on February 28th, 1969, to David Calico and Patty Dole. Tara's parents later divorced, and Patty married John Dole, who became Tara's stepfather. I'm going to do that a million times. I apologize to all the Taras out there when I say Tara by accident. And Tara did have some siblings, or has siblings, including a stepsister. And Tara was very athletic. She loved cycling. She would go on these long bike rides. She was studying psychology and pre-med at the University of New Mexico. She had a job and had a boyfriend. And the reason I'm emphasizing the boyfriend is he is not a suspect. He doesn't come up as like, because a lot of people go, oh, what did the boyfriend do? It's also really hard to find his name. The only name I've come across is Jack. I don't have a last name. I just hear Jack. And I don't even know if that's actually it or if people are using an alias for some sort of privacy protection issues or whatever. Question. It looks like you're intrigued, Robert.
Oh, I have a million questions. I'm holding back until you're ready to open up the dialogue.
The morning of September 20th, 1988, at around 9:30, she leaves her home, and her own bicycle, as we went over in the reenactment, had a flat tire. So she borrowed her mother's neon pink Huffy 10-speed bike. And she was wearing a white t-shirt, some shorts, very comfortable clothing for cycling, as you would imagine. And she brought her Sony Walkman and a cassette tape, allegedly of Boston, which is super fun to listen to as she rides on New Mexico State 47. I mentioned it was earlier as a 36-mile round trip, so it's a long bike ride. And sometimes she would take this trip with her mom, like her mom would sometimes go with her. And an interesting anecdote, because I don't know if this ties to anything in the story, but one time, Tara's mom said that she felt like she was being followed or someone was after her when they went on a bike ride. And she suggested to Tara that you should carry mace, which is why I added that line about mace in the reenactment scene. She didn't, as far as I know, carry mace. Apparently, Tara was like, I'm fine. I go on this bike ride all the time. What are you talking about, mom? Mom, you know, kind of thing. Like
that was reflected in my dialogue.
There you go. So the day she left, she went for the bike ride. And she's told her mother that if she wasn't home by noon, to come look for her because she wanted to get to this 12:30 tennis date that she had with her boyfriend. And she also later had a class that day at school at 4, I think around 4 p.m. Around 10:30 to 11:45, or I should say between those time periods, multiple motorists and later witnesses claimed to have seen Tara riding southbound on the highway, and they reported a dirty white or light gray or light green, depending on the witness.
Truck? Was this a truck?
Yes, it's a early 50s or mid 50s.
This is coming
pickup
back to
truck.
Me.
Yeah, with one of those camper shells on the back.
Right.
And they said that this was following close behind her. One witness later told investigators that his hair stood up because the truck appeared to be escorting or crowding, kind of pushing the cyclist off the road. The driver was described as a white or light-skinned man in his late 30s or 40s with red or brown hair. Then 11:45 to noon, Tara is last seen about 2 miles south of her house, and she apparently was continuing south toward the John F. Kennedy campground. Around 12:05, Tara had not returned home, so her mother drove the route to find her and pick her up, so she could get to her tennis thing, and she could never find her. So she later called the sheriff's office, and by the 21st, searchers were out looking for her, and they discovered her bits of her Walkman and the Boston cassette tape. Her mom thinks that it looks as if Tara had thrown these things like leaving a trail, like something had happened and she had this opportunity to like leave a trail and come hunt for her. Obviously, that's just an assumption. We don't know if that's actually true or not.
It's a little Hansel and Gretel vibes there, right?
Yeah. And there were signs of a struggle. I have read that there were like some tire tracks or some things that looked like maybe her tire or her bike had been pushed off the road or a car had sped away. I have not seen photos of what that actually may be, but there are comments that that happened. Neither her bike nor her body have ever been found. So I'm going to jump ahead a little bit. And this is where the story gets really interesting.
Oh, yes. I have tons of comments to ask. Yeah. And like,
please.
First of all, doesn't it seem like we as a society, we've changed in that like the era that you're talking about, serial killers could get away with stuff because not everything was being recorded 24/7, right? Just you didn't have as many security cameras, but then also you didn't have everyone who had a camera in their pocket to pull out and be like, this is the creepy truck that's following her. I feel like this kind of stuff is a lot harder to get away with nowadays.
Yeah, maybe.
Like there's a golden era for disappearances and serial killers. And I use that with as much respect as I can. I'm sorry to go off on tangents, and that may not be what you're looking for, but maybe it is. I follow a guy who releases like, he calls them like horror stories, but they're basically like, they're like a step or two away from, I don't want to say snuff films, but it's like real death, like Faces of Death kind of things. Like some of these videos where people will fall to their death or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm interested in that. I know other people are like, that's horrible. I don't want to see that. I'm interested in it. And I asked him one time, I messaged him and was kind of like, what would you say to the families of people who don't want this out there? Like you're promoting this material. And he had a kind of measured response, which is that like we as a society are interested in death. We're interested in danger. And I feel like this is one of those kinds of stories where her family may not initially really want us talking about her in this podcast, but maybe they do. Maybe they want more light shed on the case. You know, accidental deaths. I can understand the idea of like kind of being respectful to people who have met with some sort of untimely demise. But in this case in particular, it seems like it's almost disrespectful to not talk about it. Like, I think this is to try to solve this case, to try to bring whatever happened to her, just to put a point on the end of the question mark, is necessary. So I don't know. I guess there's like an ethics question about our mere discussion of a case like this, because I can understand how some people argue you shouldn't be discussing this. It's promoting more kidnappings, or, you know, it's kind of glorifying that activity. I'm assuming that she's kidnapped as opposed to she just ran off to Mexico.
I would say that we don't know for sure. I definitely don't think she ran away. It doesn't seem like she had any reason to run away. But so I think she was kidnapped or killed or killed. And that is the primary theory. But yeah, no, there's always an ethical question around true crime. Just because of the circles I move in, I discuss that a lot. And I don't have good answers for any of it. I'm a quote unquote fan of true crime because I love the mysteries. I love the stories. I'm similar to you, and like I'm fascinated by somewhat grotesque or dark tales, but I can't watch the videos of like people falling and dying and stuff like that. Like that's my limit with these kind of things where I'm like, oh God, I can't deal with that. But I do think in certain tales like this, I think it is important to talk about because it is an unsolved story. And I think if you ever want to solve these things, which we should be trying to do, you have to talk about them. You have to face them because something may come from that.
Well, they're all cautionary tales too. Like what can we learn from them?
Yes.
And I mean, she did it all right. You know, she went, she told someone where she was going. She said like, if I'm not back by this point, come pick me up. I mean, maybe she didn't take the mace, but would the mace really have made it? It could have
made
no difference
at
all.
Could have made no difference. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's an interesting thing. I could literally, maybe I should have an episode with like people on to discuss this kind of stuff, but we as humans whether it's right or wrong, have always been attracted to stories like this. And I say that generally because obviously there are people that don't like stories like this, but there are a lot that do. That's why it's a genre of entertainment. That's why there's documentaries and shows and movies and books of that stuff. And I think everybody's always going to have varying opinions of it all, but it's never going away. And also, it's always been there. People always think this is a new thing. It's not.
No.
This has always gone back.
What's even more mind-blowing is that we're solving cases now. You know, that's what's really bonkers. It's like all of these fans that are looking so much into the stuff that they're going, oh, I've got theories. Let's chase this down. Let's find out who D.B. Cooper was. Let's find out who the Golden State Killer was. Let's find out all of these answers to who's the Zodiac Killer. I think largely solved that question, you know, by fans over the years, having done enough research that you can get some pretty decent answers now if you dig. So I don't know. That stuff is fascinating to me. Anyway, sorry. I didn't mean to derail the whole conversation, but
we derailed everything. All right. So here's where things get super bizarre and even more creepy in the story of Tara Calico. About a year later, in Port St. Joe, Florida, in the parking lot of a convenience store, a woman finds a Polaroid. And in that Polaroid is a young woman and a young boy. And they're tied up, hands behind their backs. I will provide links to this in the show notes. And their mouths are covered with tape, and they're in the back of a van. And people have been able to identify that it's a white van, a Toyota cargo van, excuse me. Also in the photo is a copy of V.C. Andrews' novel, My Sweet Audrina, that happens to be Calico's favorite author, which is very interesting. The photo is then broadcast on TV on A Current Affair, and friends of Tara's family thought that it looked like Tara. So they called Patty and they're like, have you seen this?
Wait, I'm sorry. I'm not ready to move on. What's the name of the book and the author?
V.C. Andrews is the name of the author. My Sweet Audrina.
Okay. Have you ever heard of that author or that book before?
Nope.
I mean, that lends a lot of credence. I'm fairly well read and I do not know that author or that book. And if you're saying, okay, this is this person's favorite author, that's quite the coincidence.
I'm actually pulling it up right in front of me. She's an American novelist best known for her gothic novel Flowers in the Attic, which I have heard of.
Yep.
Oh, no, she has a number of series, and My Sweet Audrina is a very successful one. So I think we just are not as well read as we thought.
All right, well, maybe that's just not our wheelhouse.
Yeah, exactly.
All right.
So this photo comes out, like I said. Patty takes a look at it. She thinks that it could be Tara. And so obviously people are like, oh my God, is she alive? That's the amazing part. Yeah. That's the big one. And if she is alive, how'd she get in Florida? Who has her? Maybe that was a car in the parking lot right for that. And she's there. Let's investigate.
Maybe she's being sold in the black market.
Possibly. And so different organizations look at the photo to analyze it, including Scotland Yard and also Los Alamos National Laboratory and the FBI. They've all examined the photo. They all say different things. Mm. Some people say that's likely Tara to a certain high degree. Some are like, no, definitely not. It is very intriguing. There's also the boy in the photo is younger than she is, like maybe 12, 13, something like that. And it was assumed that he was a boy named Michael Henley, also of New Mexico, who disappeared, I think, 60 to 70 miles away from where Tara had disappeared, also in 1988. So people started connecting this together. However, I will quickly jump on that because this story is well known. So I don't want to like hold that as a cliffhanger and say it later. But Michael Henley was actually found near where he disappeared later. His body was found. They think he got lost while hiking and camping with his family and sort of succumbed to the elements. So it is not Michael Henley in the photograph, which is too bad. But this photo is why I knew of the case. I've seen this photo. You mentioned the photo earlier.
Yeah.
And these stories where you see the quote unquote last photo of somebody. It is terrifying. I will say while the Polaroid has brought attention to this case and it is very frightening, it might not have helped the investigation because it almost like, if it's derailed not her, it. You can get derailed. If
talking
it's
about
not,
derailing.
Yeah.
Derailing conversation, derailing the investigation. She got derailed while she was riding her bike. There's a lot of derailing today.
Absolutely. And then now I'm going to jump ahead. In 2008, there's another twist to the...
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
This story.
Okay.
Sheriff Rene Rivera of Valencia County Sheriff's Office publicly claimed that he had credible information that Tara was accidentally struck by a truck driven by 2 local teenagers who knew her. And according to the sheriff, the teens panicked, abducted her, killed her to conceal the accident and hid the body. And Rivera said that the body was likely buried nearby, but he refused to name the suspects, saying that he hadn't have found the body, so there's no evidence to file charges, and he's not going to name who the teenagers are.
No, come on now.
This is, I think it was Tara's family, and if not them directly, it's like friends of the family and other people have just been like, why make this announcement? Like, if you can't charge anybody, you haven't found anything, or you're unsure, like, why announce this? Like, it seems very odd.
That seems like a dereliction of duty. I mean, like, okay, first of all, you're right. Like, why are you even putting that out there? But if you are going to put that out there, as a family, I would be furious. I'd be like, look, we think she's still alive. We think she's kidnapped. And you're not following that lead. You're going down this lead of she was killed by a couple of classmates. But yet you're not even pressing charges for that? Like, one or the other here, bud. Like, let's get something going. And you're just going, can't find a body, so it didn't happen.
What? Absolutely. Well, there's more to the case, Robert. It keeps going. Keeps going as the years go on. Nothing's found. Nothing seems to come from that.
This is one of those Russian stacking dolls. There's always something underneath.
There's always something underneath. In 2013, a man named Henry Brown, who, if I'm correct in my research, was a retired teacher or at least worked at the local school in town, and he allegedly told police, I've read the police report of this, so he definitely had talked to people, but we don't know if it's true or not, but he told people on his deathbed that he had seen Tara's body wrapped in a tarp in the basement of Lawrence Romero Jr., who was son of the sheriff when Tara disappeared. And Brown claimed that Romero Jr. and 3 others, and their names are known, I'm electing not to say their names just because I felt weird about it for a variety of reasons. And so I'm just saying, Romero Jr. and 3 others hit Tara with a truck, abducted her, raped her, and then killed her when she threatened to report them. Brown alleged that the men hid the body in a bush, later moved it to the basement where Romero Jr. was living in a trailer, and then later disposed of the body in a pond. And Romero's father helped cover up the crime. So that's the allegation. Romero Jr., who apparently did this, died by suicide in 1991. That's the official claim, is suicide. The father argued that he was murdered. A friend said it was an accident. He was basically playing with a gun in his trailer and his friend was nearby and the gun went off. So there's some debate about how he died, but I think officially it is a suicide. Although reading it, I think he would play with his guns all the time. He was a bit, he dealt with drugs and he lived in a trailer. I think he accidentally.
This doesn't sound like a strong candidate of someone who's going to go on to cure cancer. This seems like, I never wish death on anyone, but it does seem like, this seems like an unsavory character.
Yes. Yes. I will say his father, who again was the sheriff, claimed that he disagreed with the forensic reports and was going to have them disappear, which I think is that wasn't the exact word, so don't quote me on that, but something like that, which I think is an interesting thing for a sheriff to say. It's very much that authoritarian, I don't like those, so I'm just going to change the records. And it's like, no, the people whose job it is to know these things said it was suicide. So that was in 2013 that this Henry Brown person says all this before he dies, saying it was a deathbed confession. He wanted to get it off his chest.
And he was, I'm sorry, who he was? He was the police?
This is a person who worked for the school.
Oh, for the school.
Yeah, yeah. And he knew, basically, small town, a lot of people know everybody, and he was like hanging out with Romero Jr., who apparently had the body in the basement. They were like hanging out drinking, I think. I will say all of these allegations they've never been corroborated. So this didn't lead to anything. They've never been confirmed or backed up. I think they've even looked in for the body in the places that came out of what he was telling people, and they couldn't find it. So whether it's true or not, I can't say. It very well might not be true.
Well, if it's the guy's dad that's doing the looking,
It does. Well, I think by this point, the dad wasn't around anymore. So okay. I think it's the new sheriff. Just very quickly, I won't go into all the details because it gets a little confusing. And I think it's because we live in the internet age. And when you research, I don't like to use Reddit for specific details. I like to use it to like point me in a direction or find opinion. But people say opinion as fact on Reddit, so you can get a little lost. But there are people that think the current sheriff is also part of some kind of cover up.
Okay.
And so I would just want to say that I don't know what I trust when I read that, but there are people that think that. And there you go. And we're not done yet. The Russian doll keeps coming apart.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Another layer.
There's more to this.
Another babushka lady.
Yes. Before I go into the next strange things that have happened, let me tell you a couple other hypotheses.
I think it's hypotheses.
Hypotheses? Hypothesis I, maybe? Yeah. Is the FBI briefly investigated the case, and there was a theory that David Parker Ray, the so-called toy box killer, that was a hard sentence to say, might have been involved because he had a family ranch nearby. It was later ruled out. Also, the Polaroid that I said could, if it's not her, could derail you. It looks like most people now think that that's not her. Like that little needle has leaned farther and farther away from it being Tara, not just because of allegations coming out around her hometown, but also more Polaroids were found with people that are women that everybody's like, oh my God, it's Tara, and in various places, to the point that some of them are very likely hoaxes. And there are people that think even that Polaroid was a hoax. Yeah. And there's a lot of reasons why. One is like the type of tape on the mouth. People are like that tape would come off. And they're also like everybody's hands are tied behind their back, but yet they have a book and like water and stuff nearby. And it's like, well, how are they reading the book if they don't have hand? Like it just felt a little strange.
So turn the page with your nose.
Yeah. I mean, you know, who knows? So anyway, I'm just saying it's very likely not Tara in the photo, even though the photo is what continues to get attention for this case to this day. In 2013, a six-person task force was formed by Valencia County Sheriff's Office to review the case. It was disbanded about a year later because they couldn't find anything new. In 2019, the FBI offered a $20,000 reward for information leading to Tara's recovery or the arrest or conviction of those responsible. There's also a woman who knew Tara and kind of grew up around her, who is a filmmaker that's made a very detailed podcast. She's done a lot of the investigation. She shows up in a lot of field notes and reports and knows this case better than anybody. And I will provide links to that work in the show notes. She now has the podcast on Patreon only. So I couldn't, you know, share a lot of the details directly with that. And she wants Tara to be found and has a lot of her own theories into the case. And in 2021, investigators execute a sealed search warrant at an undisclosed residence in Valencia County. The details of that have not been made public. 2 years later, 2023, so now we're really recent. This is the new information. New meaning 2 years ago, new. At a press conference, Sheriff Denise Vigil and Lieutenant Joseph.
I think it's Lieutenant. I don't think it's Lieutenant.
Lieutenant Joseph Rowland state that law enforcement believes there's sufficient evidence to submit this investigation to the district attorney's office for review of potential charges.
We are here today to talk about the progress of the Tara Calico case. With very little resources, law enforcement has never given up on finding out what happened to Tara Calico. I personally was not sure I would ever see the day of a significant breakthrough. But here we are today, as I stand before you and confident of the findings in this case. Tara's family has suffered long enough. Tara's parents are no longer with us, but we do have Tara's remaining family. The people responsible will soon have to answer to this family and to the community who has never stopped thinking of Tara. We know there have been numerous theories about what happened to Tara. To preserve the integrity of the investigation, we cannot reveal all that has been learned. But rest assured, investigators have followed up on all theories, leads, and tips. When we can share case updates or information, we will do so directly to the community through the official channels.
There's been some follow-up, but nothing has publicly been announced over who is of interest in the case.
Sorry, so what does that mean? That basically, it's an announcement that there's no announcement?
It's kind of an announcement that there's no announcement because here we are 2 years later and there still has not been an arrest. But to me, it means there's information. There's information, there's evidence that points to somebody. We don't know why that hasn't led to an arrest yet. It could be, you know, there's a lot of legality to these things that are probably very important for our rights in this country at play here, even if we would like to see somebody arrested. But it's fascinating that here we are, 1988 to 2023, and they're like, we think we know who's responsible. And my personal theory is that it might have been this Romero Jr. guy that this other dude had mentioned years ago, because he is dead. And I think that could, and he definitely had like quote unquote accomplices with him. So maybe a few of those people are still alive and that's who they were searching with. But I think that could hold things up theoretically, that some of these people are dead now that were involved. But holy crap, the fact that that's even that far and they have that much information is fascinating. Like you said, people are now like, we're solving old cases now. And hopefully this leads to some kind of resolution for Tara Calico and her family.
That's Tara Calico. And it's Calico. Do you think that, I wonder what the, like, what's the over under for when some of these files should be shared with the public?
That is a good question. Cause I think every state's a little different. I think types of cases are different. I think if it's being kept sealed, there's a very, very good reason for that.
Well, there could be evidence too. Like, for example, what if it wasn't? This may be a bad example. What if it wasn't Boston that was in the tape, but it was Chicago? No, it was something different, right? And
yeah.
The killer would know that, you know, and they don't want to release. That, I mean, that's a bad example because it sounds like they found the tape later on anyway, but something along those lines, like only the killer would know this. And so we don't want to release all the information because that kind of blows the ability to verify whether that person really was the killer. But at the same time, it also seems like there's just too many cases that aren't getting solved by police. Because they're just overwhelmed, right? They just have too high of a caseload, and there's people out there like yourself, and you know these other people who are doing these podcasts that are going to get to the bottom of it. And just by talking about the mystery, people have spare time; they want to get into it. Let them get into it.
Yeah, yeah, and like I think the best example of that in this case is the woman that knew Tara Calico and is making, has made a podcast, has also been working on a documentary for a long time. She's intimately involved with this. She's talking to people on the ground, whereas I don't do that on my show. If someone wants to fund me to do that, please give me a shout. But otherwise, I think people like her are pushing this forward more than anybody else because she's actually, quote unquote, investigating this like a real investigator. But that's all me just agreeing with you of like, yes.
Yeah, but I mean, maybe this show is a drop in the bucket and there's someone else who's pouring directly from the fire hose in the bucket. And so your drop may not ultimately solve the case, but you are adding to the solvability of the case by keeping it in the zeitgeist, by continually discussing it and kind of bringing up new ideas, discussing it with other people and having other people hear
that conversation and going off on their own and thinking about looking up photographs of, what does this mean? And let's solve this puzzle together collectively. And that's what's, I'm sorry to like, to get lost in the weeds on it, but maybe I'm not sorry. I'm not going to apologize for it. I'm not even sorry. You know that scene in American Beauty where the next door neighbor kid is like videoing the bag and the bag is like swirling around in the wind, and he's talking about how beautiful that is. And it's one of those things that, like, if someone else were to come along and just see the bag, they'd be like, just the bag. But there's a beauty in it. And I feel that way a lot. I get kind of overwhelmed by the beauty of like what's going on within our world. And I do think that there's a beauty in the way that humans solve these kinds of problems, and we do it collectively, almost like ants. Like, it's weird, and we have this ability unlike any other animal species. Sorry to get like kind of trippy on you, but like, we have the ability to communicate across time. Now, it's only one direction. Like, we can write something down and thousands of years later other humans can read that and understand that. I'm not sure that's the case for dolphins, you know, like, but we have this ability to directly communicate. We can know what Aristotle was thinking. And the clues that were left by the police in this particular case can help solve the puzzle, even if it's 100 years after, you know, we might, the theory of her body being in a pond. We had to dredge this pond because there's new residential buildings being put in there. Oh, we found a skeleton. Let's run DNA testing. It was her. Like, the whole time, those theories can be verified if we have all the clues available to us. So I don't know. I think there's something beautiful about that. And I guess I often see like police work being stymied by their limitations, and no fault to the people who are doing it, but more of just like, you only have so many resources to throw at a case, and at a certain point it becomes like, we just can't spend that much time and effort and money on this.
There's this instinctual feeling around this case that someone there in town knows more than they've said.
Right. But I guess, like, well, you're definitely right. I mean, somebody knows something or knew something, and maybe they're dead now and they took that secret to the grave with them. But somebody has to have known something, because no reasonable person would suspect that she just up and left, and that she's like living a new life in Idaho without her social security number or something like that. No reasonable person really believes that. She met some sort of foul play.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm going to add this one thing, and I apologize. I didn't write down in my notes all the information. I will have links to, there's a lot of great notes and resources out there on the case. I'm going to provide all those in the show notes. I will say real quick too, since this is an open case, if you have information about it, you can call the Valencia County Sheriff's Office. It's 505-866-2400 and or the FBI Albuquerque Office, 505-224-2000 for any tips or information. There are some police reports that are available publicly that I'll put out there, because it has so many more details than I plan to talk about today. The thing I was about to bring up is the local podcaster who's been looking into this that knew her. She's in even some of the field notes, but she claims that she felt like someone was threatening her and coming after her. She's had some situations. I haven't talked to her directly or been able to listen to her whole podcast, so I don't know the details of that. But it sounds like she's run into some issues with people threatening her around her digging into this case as well, which adds a little extra feeling of something's going on there or went on there in that town dealing with Tara's disappearance that we just don't know.
Do you think, you know, you mentioned earlier that most likely, generally speaking, that she probably was still left in that town. I wonder if the Polaroid even is fake, if there's a universe where she's taken somewhere else, you know, and taken to,
it's very possible, yeah,
Mexico and sold into sexual slavery or something like that.
You're right on the border, and there is human trafficking, and there always has been. So I do think that is a possibility. I lean more towards, just me personally, after all this, I definitely feel like she's dead and she's there, like somewhere nearby. But I do think it is a very valid theory that she could have just been on the road. It's very rural. Not many people around. Someone pulls up, knocks her over, grabs her, and takes her across the border, you know?
Yeah, to me that seems like a kidnapping. I mean, was the bike found?
No, the bike and the body are both missing.
Well, one thing that do you remember the, right after September 11th, I think it was like a year after September 11th, do you remember Washington, D.C. had the sniper stuff that was going on, the D.C. sniper, Beltway sniper?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you remember much of what was going on during that time, but for like, it was like a month they were being terrorized. And my mom lived in D.C. at the time. She lived there during 9/11. She always said that the sniper was more terrifying than even September 11th because it was just so long and it prevented you from going out into public because everyone was getting killed and it didn't matter your age or your race or anything like that. But one of the things that was interesting is everyone was looking for this white van. And I don't know if you recall that, but they kept talking about white van, white van, white van. And literally the police were just pulling over white vans. And if anybody saw a white van, people were painting their vans to try to be like, it's not me, you know, that kind of thing. it's a blue van. I think it could be, and it turned out, by the way, to not be a white van at all. They were always in this like blue car that had like a special license plate that had flipped down and they were shooting from inside the car. My point in bringing that up is it's interesting how often vehicle sightings could be completely innocent. Could be completely innocent, have nothing to do with, with the case at all. So maybe there was someone who was trailing behind her for a minute, but they had car trouble and then got back on the road and took off. And now that car is like this big clue that may be like, that's actually not a clue at all.
It may be nothing. I've definitely covered some stories on this show and even on some TV show stuff where there are clues that I've tried to point out of like, this could be a really big clue and everybody talks about it, but it also may not be. And the truck is one of those. It's a great example of we saw this truck, but that doesn't mean, oh my God, the killer had this green early 50s truck. And if it was this Romero Jr. guy, he didn't drive a truck like that, as far as what I've read. So yeah, maybe the truck is nothing.
I guess this gets into like police work in general, and it's the difference between like a board game or a movie where clues always lead to the solution, right? When you play Clue, you know that the rope was not in the dining room or whatever. Like it's you can cross that off your list. And the same with like movies, that we don't give false clues in movies and stories that we tell and things like that. But in real life, it's very messy. And you oftentimes have erroneous clues that lead you in a totally different direction. And those clues can derail your thinking. And that's dangerous, where now you're not keeping an open mind as to what can happen.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it happens a lot. I think the Polaroid, I'm a believer that the Polaroid is not her. I think if it is a real Polaroid of two young people being kidnapped, I think it's someone else, which is also incredibly terrifying and needs to be looked into.
Right.
But I don't think it was her. I don't think she looks exactly the same. Her mom talked about a scar on the leg that matched Tara, but I don't really see it when I look in the photo. I think there's other differences in the way they look and stuff. So,
did the mom believe that it was the same person?
I think she did for a while, but it definitely sounds like she's open to it not being her from some of the interviews I've seen. Yeah, but that's my point is, I think that clue could derail the investigation. I don't know if it did. I think it may have derailed amateur investigators. I'm not sure if it is, you know, like put off the real investigators in the case or not. But yeah, I think false clues, but also false clues are important if you have the time and resources to track them down, because eventually if you follow them far enough, you can't cross them off. It'd be like, oh, we found a truck that looks like an early 50s green or light blue truck with the camper shell
that was there that day.
It was driven by this 82-year-old guy visiting his brother, you know, across the state, and he didn't see
he had a mild heart attack and pull off to the side of the road, which is he was dealing with a medical issue. I don't know, something like that. Perfectly reasonable.
Yeah, but you can cross it off. And I think part of the mystery around that truck is that they never found a similar truck. But again, it could have just been passing through. It could have been a truck from another state and it was going. So you you don't know. And they don't know the exact year. Some of the things you read, people get very specific about the year. They don't know the exact year. They just think early 50s. And also witnesses, when you deal with witness testimony, witnesses are horrendously bad at specifics.
Right.
And also your memory changes when you tell things, which is part of the reason why witnesses are bad. And it's important, obviously, but you can't follow it to a T. You know, you got to be open-minded when you're basing evidence based on witnesses. All right. We've taken a lot of time here to talk about this, Robert.
Are you going to hit record? Are we going to do it for real now?
Yeah, no. So that was practice.
Okay,
this
cool.
Time, let's do it. But this time you're Robert.
Okay.
And she's Tara.
I'd like to be Lieutenant Robert.
Yes, Lieutenant. I can't even say it how I accidentally said it earlier. All right. Thank you so much for doing this.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Do you have any social media or websites or anything you want to push people towards?
You can find me. My company is called Cannonball of Death. So you can usually either find me like on Instagram at Cannonball Death, Cannonball of Death, some variation of that. Nobody else is called Cannonball Death. You'll find me that way.
Nice. Well, thank you so much for this. Thank you for the insight.
Absolutely.
Into this. I was keeping the details kind of short today for a variety of reasons, mainly because I wanted to focus on the really specific stuff because you can go in the weeds on this case.
Sure.
But I really like discussing true crime in general and these kind of things. I have so much fun doing it. So I really appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
You've just listened to A Study of Strange. Consider helping us keep the lantern lit, illuminating the unexplained, by subscribing to our Substack. Just head to the support tab at astudyofstrange.com. Or leave a quick review and tap that subscribe button, which helps us reach more curious minds. Until next time, stay curious and stay strange.